Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we celebrate Star Wars' 30th anniversary with a member of the 501st Legion, which is a group of fans who dress up like members of the Evil Empire. We spend a morning scoping out hidden treasures at garage sales, find out about the world's only theremin lounge band, and talk with Wizard of Oz munchkin Mickey Carroll. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. As movie stars go, the munchkins from The Wizard of Oz were not all that prolific. For many, it was their only shot in Hollywood, but renewed interest in the movie over the past two decades has brought the few who are still alive out from the shadows for countless charity events and personal appearances. One of them lives in the St. Louis suburbs. Michael Finocchiaro is better known as Mickey Carroll, and he's just a few months away from turning 88. Tom Weber recently visited with him.
First rule when you're interviewing Mickey Carroll, keep your recorder running. After finishing our interview in which he threw out nuggets like this,
"We represent the Lollipop Guild."
We were walking out and I thought I caught a glimpse of him falling. I turned, he sprang. It wasn't a fall, it was a dance. Lesson learned, never turn your tape recorder off around a guy who's always on. Mickey was born and raised in Belle-Nor and got some of his first breaks in vaudeville at the Fox Theater. He traveled a lot from show to show. The draw was his 4.5-foot stature, but they stayed for the singing and dancing.
When I was in vaudeville, then four shows a day, I open up the curtain. I can see who's in the audience. So I know what I'm going to do. I can talk, I can sing, and I used to always check my audience. Always.
Around age 20, Mickey drove to California to film The Wizard of Oz. At the time, it was just a few weeks on a movie set, one of any number of performances in a career. Still, there was Judy Garland.
Somewhere over the rainbow.
When she sings "Over the Rainbow," God, I want to commit suicide.
Why?
It's so beautiful. Just knowing her keeps me young. Keeps me, I'm a kid.
And there the kid is, one of 124 munchkins welcoming Dorothy to Munchkinland right after her house killed one witch and another good witch shows up.
Come out.
The good witch then tells all the munchkins to come out, don't be afraid.
And Kansas, she says, is the name of the star.
All right, stop, right there. Right after the good witch sings, "Kansas is the name of her star," the munchkins respond in kind.
"Kansas, she says, is the name of the star."
The shot then cuts to a bunch of munchkins, and right after your eyes focus on one of them crawling up from a hole, you will then see another munchkin dressed in purple walk across the front of the screen. That purple munchkin is carrying a bell, he's the town crier, and that is Mickey Carroll. Mickey is also in that scene as a soldier and fiddler, but the town crier bit was his real 15 minutes, or really 2 seconds, of fame.
Being a munchkin, I make so many people happy. They recognize me.
When Mickey's stage days ended, he returned to the family business in St. Louis, making gravestones. Re-releases of the movie in recent years, plus videotape and DVD, upped the demand for appearances by cast members who were still alive. Mickey loves an audience and always has a story, which will be based in truth, but you can't forgive the ever-performer for spicing them up at times.
My dad was a sculptor in Italy. He made the Thomas Jefferson Memorial when he was 8 years old in Italy.
Elaine Willingham has known Mickey for years, in part through a newsletter she wrote about the movie and Munchkins. She says she's constantly amazed by his charity.
I've done a lot of book signings with him where they have a time on it. It'll say, you know, Mickey Carroll from 2 to 4 or something. Mickey will stay there and talk to everybody if it takes him till 6 o'clock.
As for appearances, there are already plans for Mickey to throw out the first pitch at a Cardinals game in 2 years on his 90th birthday.
I love people because they love me for my movie, not for me. I got underwear older than you, Tom. I'm a nobody but a munchkin. See what a munchkin can do? See, just a munchkin. Ain't that something? And I'm still alive to enjoy it.
I'm Tom Weber.
You have to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. You find he is a wizard of wiz, if ever a wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one because of the wonderful things he does. You have to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is Sidetrack. Drive around on the weekends during the summer and you can't help but see yard signs popping up like weeds everywhere. Garage sale season is definitely underway. Sidetrack's Matt Kessler followed one garage sale goer, Gail Taylor, as she hit various spots in Champaign one beautiful Friday morning in May. He brings us this audio postcard.
So I haven't taken anyone garage sailing for a long time. I usually go out with women friends and they all work on Fridays. So I'm just out kind of doing my own thing today, which is fun. So the nice thing about garage sailing is you get to get out and look in neighborhoods that you might not spend a lot of time hanging out in normally. And for me, I always bring a cup of coffee and I kind of get in that frame of mind that you need to be in, because this can be really hard work depending on what you're looking for and what you're doing. You know, I do it for fun, but there are a lot of people that do it kind of for a living. This is bad to say, but you kind of know what neighborhoods are in town, and so you can kind of know, okay, if you go to this end, it's going to be high end. If it goes to this end, you know, it's kind of working class, you know, it might be upper class. I know some people that only shop at high end sales, so they'll go like to Southwest Champaign or Yankee Ridge or someplace where the money is. For me, it's the fun of doing it. And I also recognize that people do this to make a living, you know, and to make a little money, and they might use it for vacations or whatever. Usually, small sales, you can make about between $300 and $500. And it just kind of depends, what are you selling and what do you have on it. So I have a good friend in England, they have jumble sales where they just kind of take things, you know, to a big city center and that's it. But they don't have it at their homes. And that's what's cool about this. This is America.
Thank you.
You bet.
Oh, now like this. Oh, these are great. Okay, so these were old candy boxes, and so they used to have Valentine's candy in them, and they make really neat gift boxes for people. So like I can put rhinestones on them, or, you know, just put little thingies, charms, pictures, whatever. Now these, you might want to get these license plates to make birdhouses. So you bend the license, and you make it for the roof. So those are kind of fun. See, 1969. 50 cents. So let's see, here we have a Santa mobile. That's kind of cool. What do you think? What is that? Yeah, don't see anything in there. Oh, Cher. Where was Cher? Britney Spears. Okay. Nope, nothing there. So one of the things when you make a list is that you should cross off where you've been so you don't go back to the same sale, because I've done that before when I used to go to a lot of sales. So like I've went to the one on North McKinley, so that one's off. And we just went to the one on West Healy. So now we could go to one on North Russell, North Draper, West John, or Grandview. I don't get mad at people because we all have our own reality of life, and I mean, if they think they have the greatest sale, they think they have the greatest sale. You know, there was stuff there that people would be looking for, but I wasn't looking for it. Today I thought I was going to do a lot of library work. I was going to go and spend at least 4 or 5 hours working at the library, doing readings and typing things up, and I had thought that by now I'd be back home and I'd be heading to work. You know, I feel guilty that I'm doing this. And it's like, well, no, I deserve some free time. I've worked really hard this week. Yeah, no, that's really nice.
Oh, it is. Is it nice? Yeah. You know, somebody gave it to my son. Yeah. And when he moved, I ended up with it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, I bought it, but I don't have any floors to put it on anymore.
I rolled that up. I did think that was pretty.
So for me, I've always enjoyed garage sailing because you get out into the community and you see people, you talk to people, you'll run into people you know, and like you're finding out there's lots of casual conversation, and it's real easy to strike up conversations.
You're right. I probably had it at Baytown.
I think if you ask each person, they have their own philosophy about why do we do these things, and that I'm just thinking about my parents, you know, from having grown up during the Depression, and that you saved everything. Paper clips, rubber bands, glass jars, anything that you could reuse, you saved it and you hung on to it. You know, where now it's like we don't have to do that because we can go to the grocery store and we can just buy whatever, if we have the money to buy it. But maybe it's because we have more money that we're doing this. What do you think? Well, when I meet people from other countries and you talk about it, I think, first of all, what is a garage sale? And what are you doing? And why are you doing it? And that, I don't know if it's because are we a throwaway culture? You know, and that there's this whole suggestion that, you know, we're very materialistic and that, you know, we buy more than we need. And so consequently, we have more to get rid of. And so we have sales, or we put things out along the curb and say free, you know, just haul it off our hands, you know, or we take it to wherever to get rid of it. Yeah, and I don't know if it's just our culture. Yeah, I'm not sure, but, you know, I kind of like to, you know, it's kind of like with your fall and spring wardrobe, you change your clothes to fit the season. Well, I think the same holds true. What I might have owned 20 years ago, I might own pieces and parts of that now, but I might own something that's totally different.
I think you might want to keep it.
I don't want it. Well, do you want it?
Well, I might roll
hers. if it ended up in my house, yeah. I said, come and look at stuff, otherwise yeah. It's gone.
Garage Sale Shopping with Gail Taylor from Champaign. That audio postcard was produced by Sidetrack's Matt Kessler. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. 30 years ago, Star Wars hit the big screen, and for many, the world was never the same again. Today, Star Wars fandom reaches to all corners of the globe. There's one group of fans in particular who like to spend time dressed up like stormtroopers and other members of the evil empire. They're called the 501st Legion, and they have chapters called garrisons all over the world. One member of the Midwest Garrison is Jim DeJan of Forest, Illinois. I talked with him earlier this week and asked him to first explain what the 501st Legion is.
10 years ago, a gentleman from South Carolina by the name of Alvin Johnson and a friend of his thought it would be a lot of fun to build themselves stormtrooper costumes. And go to a premiere. He then posted pictures from that on a website, and other people started sending pictures of them doing the same thing. So all of a sudden, there was this influx of mindset of people building stormtrooper armor, mainly from styrene or from ABS plastics, by hand, you know, vacuum form for the most part, which means you have to build a form, you then have to refine it, then you have to heat the plastic to push over the form, and a great deal of work and time and effort. And he found that people were doing this everywhere, so to the point that this being our 10th anniversary, we now have close to 4,000 members worldwide.
Yeah, I was looking on the 501st Legion website, and you have these garrisons all over the place in Europe and South America, and of course in
Singapore.
The U.S. It's amazing how you can get guys around the world to dress up like stormtroopers. And I guess it's not just guys and girls.
The guys and gals, we have what we call our femties or femtroopers. The gals, let's face it, you really can't tell the sex of the trooper until they take their helmet off. So they enjoy it just as much as we do.
Now, how do you describe this? Is it dress up? Is it reenactment? Is it costuming? What I'm searching for the proper term.
It starts with costuming, the love of building costumes. I myself and my wife have been costuming since we were in our 20s. I'm 54 now. It just generated to the point where the maker, George Lucas, created Star Wars 30 years ago this year, this week, and gave us a whole raft of a wealth of characters to portray.
Now, this 501st Legion, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's mostly the evil empire, people dressing up like the stormtroopers. They're not the good guys.
No, we're not. they can't shoot worth a darn either. It's pretty much basically the bad guys, mainly because we like to have some fun, and the fun being doing things for charity in our local areas and showing that bad guys can be good. There is a very iconic thing with Darth Vader coming into a room, especially, for the sake of it, a birthday party we did in Gibson City couple of weekends ago. Lord Vader comes through the door, and all you see are these saucer eyes of these little children looking up at him, and he stands about 6'2" or 6'4" in our local area here. He's in Champaign, in fact, a gentleman by the name of Chip, and this was his first day, his first outing as Vader, and he pulled it off spectacularly. Myself, I dress as a TIE pilot, which is also in black and gets mistaken for Vader once in a while. But we're working on that little costume recognition. We had Boba Fett. We had several troopers. So it was a great thing for this little young 5-year-old or so to have these people have come to his party.
In the movie universe of Star Wars, if you had the Darth Vader and all the stormtroopers come into your birthday party, I think that would be a bad sign.
Yeah, they'd be all packed up and sent off to the spice mines of Kessel. For the most part, we're there to have fun with the kids, and we don't charge for doing it. In fact, what we ask them to do is, for the most part, make a donation in the Legion's name to their favorite charity. Most of the time, it's Make-A-Wish. We do not accept gratuities. You want to feed us, that's okay, but it's a very daunting task to get all this gear on, especially if it's a day like today and close to 90 degrees and you're wearing black. It's not the most fun thing to do. But if you're walking into, say, a hospital and the children's ward, which we've done any number of times, you've never seen a trooper cry until you've seen these guys at the end of an event like that. It's the joy that we give them, that they see the figures, the action, walking action figures, as we've been described as, walk through the door to them and treat them with respect and love and caring. And that all comes really basically from our founder, Alvin, again. There is a movie, if you don't mind me plugging it.
No, go right ahead.
A fan-made film called Heart of an Empire. In fact, you can find it online. It's heartoftheempire.com. It has debuted finally this last month or so, and it's going around to different film festivals. And unlike Trekkies and the like, this tells the true story of how Albin and others in the Legion have stepped up to take care of not only others, but the region has taken care of its own. Albin lost a very sweet child to a terrible illness, and it brought the Legion together as group. And since then, we've been doing things to take care of our own, people who have been burned out of their homes, injuries and so on. And it's the camaraderie, the fun of getting together with an interest and a love of Star Wars, to go out and have fun in public. Over 300 and some of them are out in California for Celebration 4 in L.A. this past weekend. And what'd they do? They went out and had fun with their friends. And that's the whole reason we do it, to have some fun. Keeps me young, keeping up with these youngsters, these 20 and 30-year-olds with young families at the stitch. So, which is why I usually end up driving the float at a parade instead of walking it.
Now, I'm always curious about movie fans who take that step, that big step of not just watching the movie or enjoying it, but to dress up as characters from those movies.
You're talking to an old Klingon here, so just watch it, okay? we do have lives. Okay, most of these people, these kids, I call them kids because I've probably got about 20 years on most of them, are professionals, are policemen, are lawyers, are doctors. Majority of you couldn't afford to build these costumes without being gainfully employed. So it's not like they all live in their mother's basement. I'm sorry. Bill Shatner didn't always get it right, you know.
Well, I guess my question is, what is that threshold between being the person who enjoys the movie and then going out and saying, I want to make myself a costume to embody one of the characters?
I think it's also the journey of building the costume. It's a creative outlet to be as screen accurate as you can possibly be, to do the research, although most of us have done the research and we pass the information along to the newbies, as we call them. And it's the joy of, you know, showing the pride somebody gets when he brings out his costume, his or her costume for the first time, and people go, ooh, ah, over it. That's the thrill. There's nothing wrong, you know, there's nothing like that feeling of being impressing people with it. Now, sure, there are going to be people that are totally freaked, but I can't count on them. You know, that's not why we do it. We do it for ourselves, for the enjoyment of doing it. And the fact that we have other people who enjoy doing it with us just makes it all that much better.
That was Jim DeJan. He's a member of the 501st Legion, a group of very devoted Star Wars fans. Still to come on the program, Project Pimento, the world's only theremin lounge band, and we talk to the editor of the Oxford American about their recent Southern movie issue. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. Mark Smirnoff is the editor and publisher of Oxford American Magazine, the Southern literary publication based in Arkansas. A few months ago, Jeff Bossert spoke with Mark on the Afternoon Magazine about the always eagerly anticipated music issue, the one that comes with its own CD. For its second ever Southern movie issue, the Oxford American tried something a little different. In addition to numerous contributions from writers, the magazine comes with a DVD containing scenes from films about the South, made in the South, or with some other Southern connection. Jeff recently talked with Mark Smirnoff about the latest issue and the role the region plays in film history.
I think these movies about the South are often just very strange, and especially when Hollywood handles it. And the South can be a hard place to interpret, and that can be seen in a lot of Hollywood depictions of the South. But in these depictions, whether there are misinterpretations or not, say so much about this region and how people view the region, and that's all tied up with so much as well, race in particular. So, and there have been so many attempts to nail the South on film that it just seemed like a natural idea to do it. I guess it was back in 2001 when we did our first issue. And it actually turned out to be our most successful issue ever. And then this year we decided to do another movie, a Southern movie issue, but this time with our first ever DVD.
Talk about the portrayal. Is you feel like part of why you've done this a couple of times is to help get rid of that stereotype, or to talk about some of the diversity that comes out of the South?
Yeah, you know, and it's not like it's a crusade. I mean, I understand that, you know, there are misinterpretations of the South, but you know, in the big scheme of things, you know, I don't think it's a big deal. On the other hand, you know, it is still annoying to hear that people still see like Deliverance as a touchstone as far as portraying the South. And they're all, you know, I was thinking about it the other day. I did an interview with Morgan Freeman, and I asked him what his favorite Southern movie was, and he said, oddly enough, Driving Miss Daisy, which is not a movie everybody loves. But he had this great point. He said, "What I love about Driving Miss Daisy is that there are so many movies that focus on the differences between blacks and whites, and this particular movie, Driving Miss Daisy, focused on the connections that blacks and whites make no matter what." You know, it's like no societal pressure, no ugliness, nothing could stop real connections from being made. And that's sort of, I mean, in a way, I feel like you have to almost be very understanding or inside the South to see things that way, because that is not the normal way that outsiders look at the South. They tend to focus on the differences or the problems, but not everything else that's going on.
Talk about the DVD and how you went about selecting these clips. Were they all just scenes from movies that your different contributors had written about?
Well, kind of. I mean, the idea is kind of wonderful in a way, because what we tried to do was find scenes from movies that stand alone and that work effectively without you knowing the beginning or the end. It all started off when the director, Joey Lauren Adams, showed me the scene from her new movie, Come Early Morning, which stars Ashley Judd, which I know was just shown up there. And she told me at one point, she said, I don't care if everybody hates my movie, I'm proud of this one scene. Of course, everybody did not hate her movie, but she said, this is the one scene that I'm just proud that I've done. And she showed it to me, and I loved it too. And I didn't need to know anything about the characters before the scene and after the scene for the scene to work. And then that opened up this idea in my head, like, what if we just got all these great scenes and short films and put them together like we would a mixtape for music?
Joey Lauren Adams brought Come Early Morning to Ebert Fest up here recently and got to do Q&A afterward and talked about making a personal film and a movie that the focus on Ashley Judd's character. She learns to love herself. It's a largely, I guess, somewhat of a character study and a very personal movie.
Yeah, and, you know, to me, Joey Lauren's movie is very much a portrayal of a certain community, a certain area. You know, it's quiet in a way that I don't think Hollywood is necessarily comfortable with. It's quiet, but dramatic as well and potent as all out. You know, the fact that this movie it happens to be made by a true blue Southerner means that she presents these things that that outsiders would just miss, and then maybe they're not all that important all the time. Like there's one scene where the Ashley Judd character, she swallows some BC powder. It's just like aspirin chopped up into powder, and a lot of Southerners use it after a night of drinking. And it's all over here, but you won't necessarily find it elsewhere. But there were these great little touches that just felt like somebody was finally paying attention to the nuances and not just the story on the surface.
Another thing that I have to say about, I guess, smaller independent film, and I guess maybe somewhat of the freedom that Southern filmmakers have, she talked about having access to different locations, being in her neighborhood, essentially, and saying, you know, we can use this bar instead of that bar if need be, and Grandma will bring us cookies.
Right. That's the other thing about that particular picture is it does feel kind of homey, and you do, again, you do get that sense of community. Thank God there are now these great Southern movie makers at work. You know, an example that is like the great Craig Brewer, who's on our DVD, who just did Black Snake Moan. Ray McKinnon, he did The Accountant, which won an Oscar for short film. And all of these just feel so natural and are so revealing in non-Hollywood ways, and they're exciting.
One movie I had to bring up, I had never heard about it, and it blew me away in that one scene, was William Shatner's performance in The Intruder.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because to me, it's just unbelievable. I mean, my argument now is that William Shatner, he was miscast in his career as a good guy, and he should have been playing sleazy, smarmy sneaks, because as he proves, you know, playing such a character in Roger Corman's The Intruder, and we have this like 7-minute scene of him, there is an element, I think, of almost almost Brando in this, because he's so into the character that every movement seems true to the character. And this character is unbelievable. He's a race baiter. He comes into the small town and tries to get all the white people angry at black folks. And you know, that's one heck of a character right there.
Now, you may think the problem is simply whether we're going to allow 10 Negroes to go to our schools. That's only a small part of it. I'm in a position to know, because the Patrick Henry Society has studied the whole thing. The real problem, whether you like it or not, is whether you're going to sit back and let desegregation spread throughout the entire South. And it's an indisputable fact that there could be no other result.
I tend to think if this had been more of a film with a budget behind it, it probably wouldn't have been made with a budget at that time. But if I'm thinking, because this is a Roger Corman film, maybe that had something to do with the fact that this movie went by the radar.
Yes, and I think that's a great point, Jeff, actually, because, you know, sometimes it helps not to have money, because, you know, you have to focus on like the performance and not anything else, because you don't have anything else. I mean, they didn't have any sets. They filmed this up in a Missouri town, and everything is, you know, true blue, and you know, all they had was the story and the actors, and it's unbelievable. You know, the only thing that I don't like about the movie as a whole is, in retrospect, the black characters come across as stick figures. But other than that, it's nearly a masterpiece, and undeniably William Shatner's greatest acting ever. And it's not just Shatner's greatest acting ever; it's just great acting. I mean, so many people who have seen this come away, like you, kind of in shock. It's like, who knew Shatner could act this well?
We should move on to documentaries, because since there are a few on the disc, and recently checked out Born for Hard Luck, or at least the scene that's on there. I'd never heard of this. This is a more than 30-year-old documentary about Peg Leg Sam.
Yeah, Peg Leg Sam. I mean, I have to say, this is kind of... it's kind of controversial, and it's kind of disturbing in a way. I mean, when folks first, particularly when white folks first see it, and you see this this old black man, he's got, you know, one leg, the other leg is a peg leg, hence the nickname, and he starts walking, and then he starts hobbling, and then stops and starts tap dancing, and this guy has this face that's all scarred up, his eyes are all battered, he's frankly hard to understand. And there is this inclination for us to say, you know, to wonder, you know, how do we deal with a guy like this? I mean, is it all right to kind of laugh at him when he's making these jokes?
I'm in such hard luck if it's raining down soup at this very minute. Everybody be standing there with a spoon. Well, I'd have a fork. Yeah, yeah. I'd bone for hard luck. Da-da. The frog it went a coating and I heated right. Bad frog. The frog it went a coating and I heated right.
And in truth, you know, and I guess some people feel like, you know, this Peg Leg Sam could be a stereotype, but he's not. He's a human being that you can't deny that this guy just. I mean, he affects you. I almost don't know how to explain it. I mean, he's just so real that even though he has these, you know, disturbing tics and you can't take your eyes off him, you know, his personality cannot be denied. And he's a great storyteller. He's a great harmonica player. He's a great singer. I mean, it's like somebody from the 19th century.
Crazy Cat Goes A-Wooing. We have an old silent animated short.
Yeah, it's quite early. I think it's 1919.
But, that's right. What's the Southern connection here, or is there one?
Well, we're always snooping for those, you know, Jeff. In fact, that's our whole life, looking for Southern connections. Crazy Cat was a groundbreaking cartoon that was created by a New Orleans person named George Harriman. And that was all the Southern connection we needed. And it's pretty amazing to see this early cartoon, this 1919 cartoon. You see this art form forming in front of your very eyes. I mean, you can see them trying to figure out how to use cartoons. And, you know, it's both primitive and not at the same time. I mean, it's not primitive in the sense that it still works.
Let's go back into just the magazine itself. You've got a lot of suggestions for someone to, you know, just take the magazine to the video store or line up their Netflix queue and learn a little more about some movies that explore the South in other ways. I mean, I guess some essential ones in there. You mentioned Birth of the Nation. There's an article on Jezebel. And I'm sure there's more that will prompt another Southern Mute movie issue.
Yeah, and on top of that, you know, it's like some of the DVDs where we just have the scenes, like whether it's The Intruder or Joey Lawrence Come Early Morning or The Puffy Chair, you see the scenes and you want to see the whole movies. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's just so many great pictures, like Baby Doll. I mean, that's still one of my favorite Elia Kazan movies. I mean, Elia Kazan did so many great movies, and so many great Southern movies, oddly enough. But Baby Doll, which is based on a Tennessee Williams script, I think is one of his best and certainly one of his craziest. And I think it was the first movie to be banned by the Catholic Church in America. And yet it is racy, but it's also quite fun and over the top. But, I mean, you know, through the good, the bad, and the ugly, there's always been some great movies from and about the South. And, you know, even though I have all these problems with Hollywood's depiction of the South, in instances like Baby Doll, they just produce something special. You know, it's just, I don't know what it is about this region, but maybe it just sort of brings out, you sort of have to engage it in, as a movie director, in all these strange new ways. You can't just kind of close your eyes and think you'll be able to deal with the South. You know, you have to sort of take it on, you know, full speed ahead with your eyes open, and it often gets the better of you.
What about some of your contributors? Do you reach out to them and say, I'm going to do another Southern movie issue, and they're like, oh boy, and you get like a flood of articles, or how does that work?
Yes and no. I mean, a lot of people are enthusiastic about the subject, so, you know, we just have to mention it, and we get all these ideas streaming in, and then sometimes we go after these folks and you know, try to get new writers in, and like one guy who's never written for us is Tom Carson, who works at GQ and has won 2 national magazine awards when he was back at Esquire for his critical writing on movies. And we got him to write about the Southern movies of Paul Newman, because for some weird reason, Paul Newman spent a lot of his early career making Southern movies. So we thought it'd be interesting to focus on that. And then, like, you know, there's, like, Gerald Early writing about Birth of the Nation, which, you know, I think can only really be seen as a historic document almost, rather than, like, a movie to just watch, you know, with a bag of popcorn, because it's so disturbing. But Mr. Early, who's an African-American, writes about it from that perspective and then uses that to talk about these blaxploitation movies that he grew up watching. And, you know, you get these high-powered, totally interesting writers, and they just come at you from all these angles. Like, Gerald Early is the first person who I've read who lists To Kill a Mockingbird as his least favorite Southern movie, which is kind of a revolutionary thought, because most people have it right up there as their favorite. And Tom Carson lists A Cool Hand Luke as one of his least favorite movies. And again, that's a movie that a lot of people just love. So we like challenging people, we like turning the tables, and we like challenging ourselves.
That was Mark Smirnoff, editor of Oxford American Magazine. Their Southern movie issue is now available on newsstands. You can check out their website at oxfordamericanmag.com. He spoke with Jeff Bossert. This is Sidetrack. Forest Park is the last stop on Chicago's Blue Line subway. Famous for its plethora of graveyards, this suburb is also the final stop for many Chicagoans. In a place with more dead residents than living ones, one particular gravesite catches visitors' attention, Showman's Rest, a graveyard for circus performers from around the world. The story of the graveyard goes back to a tragic circus train wreck in 1918. Producer Shannon Heffernan has more.
I'm not really sure what sort of mood I'm supposed to be in as I drive to Showman's Rest. I mean, imagining a clown burial is the saddest and the funniest thing I can think of. It's storming, and I feel like I'm in the opening scene of a horror movie. But as I get close, the clouds begin to part. I've asked Wendy McClure to drive me out here, because she grew up in the area and seems to know a lot about the graveyard. She stops the car in front of five large elephant monuments.
We came out here once in high school, and someone said, oh, let's go see the elephant graves. And you're like, well, what's that? And I think everyone had a different story. And one story that we heard was, years ago, there was some sort of circus train wreck, and the elephants were killed, and because they couldn't move the elephants for some reason, they just buried them out here. And then you're like, oh, a circus train wreck? That's ridiculous.
Like any good graveyard legend, there are ghosts involved. Wendy tells me that on summer nights, when the air is thick and still, you can hear the sad moaning of elephants burning in a train wreck. The whole story seems a little far-fetched, but as we poke around, it becomes clear that something strange did happen here. Wendy shows me a tombstone marked Baldy and another one marked Four Horse Driver. Both of these tombstones have the same death date as 50 or so other headstones with less unique names.
Unknown male number 45, unknown male number 44, unknown female number 43, and the dates all say June 22nd, 1918.
We poke around for clues. Wendy finds the website address for the Showman's League of America carved into a tiny granite bench. It seems a little strange to find a URL there, but I look it up and find Diane Burmeister, the Showman's League secretary. She tells me that the story of Showman's Rest begins on the Hagenbach-Wallace circus train back in 1918.
As the train was coming down the track, another train was coming, barreling right down on the same track. The train had not switched over, and so the two trains just collided in a tremendous, tremendous explosion. And since everybody was asleep, it was not, nobody was up and awake and able to know really what happened. And that's why so many people passed away.
Many of the bodies were so badly charred from the fire that they were unrecognizable. No one knew how to properly deal with the bodies. Then the Showman's League of America stepped in.
Buffalo Bill, who was our first president, felt that each person is a very special person in themselves, and they should not be buried in a mass grave. Each one should have their individual tombstones.
At least 56 people died in the train wreck, and over 100 people were hospitalized. But the circus took the phrase, "the show must go on," to heart. And after missing only two performances, they were back on the road with new acts. I'm surprised at how close the real story is to the myth. But it turns out there's one part that's not true.
There were no animals on that train. There were no animals killed in that train wreck. And unfortunately, there are no, you know, or fortunately, there are no animals buried in Showman's Rest. As many people have said, at night you can hear the elephants moaning as you drive by or as you walk through. Well, what people don't realize, it's very close to Brookfield Zoo, and you get a lot of sounds from the zoo animals, and that's what people are hearing.
The stone elephants, so often mistaken for elephant graves, actually symbolize mournful guardians. After the train wreck, the Showman's League continued to bury its members below the elephants' watchful gaze.
We would get calls for people from the morgue, and they'd say, well, we found this person, and he was in a park, and he had passed away of natural causes, and we couldn't find any identification, but there was a card from the Showman's League in his pocket. And rather than have him buried in Potter's Field in Chicago, they really wanted a place for these show people to be buried that had a little more respect for them.
At first, Showman's Rest seems like it's full of contradictions. The colorful people who are buried there versus the gray headstones labeled unknown. The entertaining myths surrounding the place versus the real-life tragic story. But maybe cemeteries and circuses aren't so different. After all, we love the lion tamers because they flirt with mortality. We love the trapeze artist because they dangle over the edge of death. There we can face our fear and learn to be comfortable with it, just like in a cemetery. The performers who can do that for us deserve something special when their time comes.
That piece was produced by Shannon Heffernan with help from Pat Loeb. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack.
One early morning, as I was walking, I met a man. Went in a tavern to get a few nips, but all I had was one mint julep was the cause of it all.
San Francisco's Project Pimento is a lot like other lounge bands. They cover tunes from the likes of Henry Mancini, Burt Bacharach, and others. But how they play them is a bit unusual. They incorporate the theremin, that strange electronic instrument, into their arrangements. The band has just released their second album titled Space Age Love Songs. I recently talked to their vocalist Lola Bombay, a.k.a. Lori Carcillo, and their theremin player, a man who goes by the name of Dr. Robbie Virus. The first question has got to be, why a theremin?
You mean...
Why? You know, what's it with a theremin? Why were you drawn to it?
I'd read about it, and there was a documentary that came out on the theremin probably 12 years ago or so, and, you know, I saw that and just inspired me. Something about it really intrigued me. I wanted to learn how to play it. The idea of making music by just waving your hands in the air just seemed like a cool thing to do.
Well, for those who don't know what a theremin is, give us a brief description of the instrument and how it's played.
So visually, it looks like a sort of a box with two antennas sticking out of it. One sticks straight up in the air, and the other is a loop antenna that sticks out the side. And the instrument has oscillators inside, which make basically a radio field around the instrument. And when you put your hands in the field, by moving the position of your hands, you can control the pitch and the volume. So it's the only instrument you play without actually touching the instrument.
Now, the theremin, most people will recognize from bad sci-fi and horror films of the 1950s, sort of has a rocky past to it. What made you guys think that it would work with lounge and pop tunes?
Well, when I started playing the theremin, I also started to get into lounge music at that point, and I don't know, something just clicked in my head. I was like, oh, these two would go together.
Yeah, and I think that people are kind of drawn to the idea of the theremin, and it's almost like a gimmick, but then they come and they hear the music, and they're like, oh, this is, like, real music. This is good, and they, well, at least, you know, I think it's good. And so I we get a lot of positive comments about it, I guess.
Well, Lori, I wanted to talk to you in particular as being the singer. The theremin itself has this very vocal quality to its sound. It's very ghostly, and it's almost like you're singing a duet in each song.
Yeah. Now,
does this affect the way that you approach the songs?
Not so much. I mean, that's a very good way of putting it. I think I look at the theremin as like another lead instrument, like you might have a saxophone or a trumpet or something like that. But we do a little bit of interplay on some of the songs, and actually on a lot of the songs. And I think I do consider the sound of the theremin, I mean, trying to just sort of weave vocals in with the theremin sound.
Yes, and when we're working on arrangements, actually, you know, it comes up sometimes that Lori will kind of yell at me like, hey, you're playing in the same range as I am. Because
yeah.
They really do, you know, the voice and the theremin can sound very similar, and you have to kind of work it out so that, you know, they're not in the same space at the same time.
Right, we don't want to be shrieky.
Well, Lori, you mentioned just a while ago talking about a theremin lounge band being labeled or can possibly be labeled as a gimmicky sort of band. And you guys don't do that. You actually back what you guys up with some serious musicianship. How do you walk that line between having fun with the instrument but not falling into self-parody?
Right. That is a difficult thing. I mean, I feel like we have a sense of humor about it, but we don't like do a whole lot of shtick, and that may be part of why people like to come see us. I'm not really sure. It just kind of happens, I guess, for us. Robbie, do you have any?
Well, you know, with the theremin, it's very easy to make it sound really gimmicky. You can use a lot of vibrato and, you know, give it sort of that flying saucer sound. But I tend to avoid that. I tend to play it like a real instrument, like a melodic instrument. And so, you know, visually, you know, it's kind of a gimmick because people are like, hey, what is that? Because most people haven't seen a theremin. But, you know, audibly, it's fit into the ensemble as another instrument, as a real instrument. And so, you know, I don't make it gimmicky in the musical sense.
Well, how do you compare this new album, Space Age Love Songs, with your debut album, Magical Moods of the Theremin? How have you guys changed, and, you know, where have you guys stayed the same?
The personnel on the two albums are different. Lola and I are the only two that have played on both albums, so it's a new guitarist, a new bass player, and a new drummer. And so that has changed the sound somewhat. I also think just by playing out a lot, we've sort of refined our sound and our repertoire The first album came out maybe a year or two after we were together. And then it was, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 years between the two albums.
What's next for Project Pimento?
Well, we're going to be playing at the San Jose Jazz Festival. They have a Tuesday night series that we're going to be playing in August. And we are going to be releasing, like doing an official release for our CD, which should be coming up in a couple of months.
Yeah, other than that, we're just going to keep playing out and keep making music.
Great. And if people want to learn more about Project Pimento, where should they go?
www.projectpimento.com.
That was singer Lola Bombay, a.k.a. Lori Carcillo, and theremin player Dr. Robbie Virus, members of the theremin lounge band Project Pimento. Their latest release is titled Space Age Love Songs. Here's a little sample from the album. It's the tune Walk On By.
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on.
Music from the theremin lounge band, Project Pimento. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website. And you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to WILL.UIUC.EDU, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.